listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's amazing. First of all, let's just, you know, we have to boil this down to simple concepts. 6 months ago, more or less, maybe as much as nine, but my recollection is pretty clear that it was about 6 months ago, the United States Senate put together a budget for the United States of America and passed it and sent it to the House of Representatives. Now, over the last two or three years, a couple of times, the Republicans have passed budgets for the United States of America and sent them to the Senate. Now, the Republicans' budgets that were sent to the Senate were unacceptable to the Senate because they always included things like getting rid of Obamacare and, cutting back on Social Security and Medicare and stuff like that, you know, nuke the post office, whatever. The right-wing billionaire's wish list. And the budget proposal that the Senate sent to the House was actually, it wasn't as wild-eyed as the ones coming out of the Republican House, the Democratic budget out of the Senate. I believe if they did not get Republican votes, they had to at least have had Republican cooperation, as in not having a filibuster. So the Senate has agreed, the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate have agreed on a budget. I don't think it's a particularly good budget. It doesn't raise taxes on the rich above 50%, which is what you need to do to stabilize your markets. Doesn't include things like tariffs on imports. I mean, you know, so it's just there's a lot. But it was a budget. Because in order for government to spend money, Congress has to first appropriate that money. In other words, they have to say, you know, we've decided that we're going to have schools, or we've decided that we're going to have air traffic controllers, or we've decided that we're going to have an army. They literally, every 2 years, have to decide whether they're going to have an army. That's in the Constitution. It's only the military that has that two-year requirement on it, because the founders did not want us to have a standing army during times of peace, thus the Second Amendment encouraging us to have citizen militias. But in any case, and that was because the founders were afraid of the military turning into what it has, which is an industry unto itself, or a military coup. And you could argue that we've had one. But setting all that aside, that whole rant, just to finish that thought, that we've had a military coup, I don't think that there would have been any discussion about invading Syria. I don't think that we would have invaded Iraq or Afghanistan. Frankly, I don't think we would have gone into Vietnam if there wasn't enormous amounts of money to be made doing it, and that money was made by a huge military-industrial complex, as Dwight Eisenhower warned us of. I mean, this is something that came along in large part with World War I and World War II. And the growing privatization of the military really started to explode during the Reagan administration. And you know how it is today. So you can call it a coup, you can call it whatever you want. But anyhow, the founders said in the Constitution that in order for the government to spend money, it has to first state that it intends to spend that money. In other words, it has to appropriate that money. And if you don't do that with a budget, then you have to do that by authorizing money for every individual piece of legislation for particular periods of time, or by continuing resolution. And a continuing resolution basically just says, you know, we're going to keep the government going for another little while until we can come up with a budget. The budget is the ideal way to do it, but it's not mandated by the Constitution. So October 1st is the end, is the beginning of the new fiscal year tomorrow is the beginning of the new fiscal year for the government. The government does not run on a calendar year. It runs on a fiscal year. So it's annual. Its year is October 1st to September 31st, I guess it is today. 30th. 30 days hath September. Right, to September 30th. And so, you know, what they've been doing is running it on these three-month continuing resolutions. Okay, we'll fund it for another 3 months. Now, why not fund it for another year? Well, because really a budget should do that. Why not fund it for another 6 months? Well, because, hey, the Republicans in the House of Representatives are saying if we can just fund it for 3 months or maybe even 2 months, that gives us another opportunity to have a, you know, hold our breath and turn blue session. I mean, that's basically what's going on here. Now, this is not yet the debt ceiling debate. That's next. This is just, are we going to keep the government open for business? We will continue to pay our bills. That's considered necessary spending, mandatory spending. But we won't be able to spend money. So about 800,000 federal employees get laid off, including a lot of people in that military-industrial complex, which has got a lot of Republicans very nervous. I thought it was particularly interesting. Last week, you recall last week when I went off on this rant, I think either Thursday or Friday, about how the real Republican agenda had been revealed, that they didn't care about social issues at all, that it was really all just about the money. They wanted to roll back Obamacare. They wanted to pass the Keystone Pipeline so that the Koch brothers can make more billions of dollars. They wanted to defund or cut back, dial back on the EPA and the Securities and Exchange Commission so that our polluters and our banksters could make more money. I mean, it was just all economic stuff. And I was like, you know, the Republicans, old-fashioned Republicans, they used to pretend that they're, you know, that in order to bring in the voters, pretend that they actually had something that they cared about other than just the interests of rich people. So they would tack on something about abortion or birth control or God in the courthouse or gay marriage or gun rights, whatever. And they didn't. Well, turns out the piece that they put together Saturday, I think probably one of them heard me on the radio and said, oh, geez, we overlooked that completely. Because the one that they sent to the Senate had in it a provision that would say that under Obamacare, employers could say to their female employees, sorry, your health insurance doesn't cover birth control. You got to buy your own birth control pills or whatever sort of birth control you want to use. Got to pay for it yourself. So like this was their, this was like the wet dish rag that they threw to the conservative base, as it were, and it's oddly not even really a conservative base. It's just that kind of little slice of, you know, social issues. So Harry Reid pulled the Senate together about an hour ago, maybe 2 hours ago. And so, okay, y'all, what do you think about this new continuing resolution that the House just sent to us? Let's have an up or down vote on it. And Ted, sorry, Senator Cruz, you cannot filibuster this. We're just going to have an up or down vote. And they voted 54 to 40, whatever it was, to say, nah. We're rejecting this. So it's now back at the House of Representatives, and it's up to John Boehner to decide whether he's going to pass the clean continuing resolution, complete with sequester, so that the government runs for another 3 months, or whether he's going to shut down the government just out of spite.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
After the break, Congressman Peter DeFazio is going to share his thoughts with us. He is in the House of Representatives, and I'm really looking forward to that. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour, and our old friend, Congressman Peter DeFazio, the Democrat ably, brilliantly representing the 4th District of Oregon. Congressman DeFazio, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Great to have you with us. So Harry Reid, in about 5 minutes, turned this thing around that John Boehner had sent him over the weekend, turned this thing around and said, nah, we'll pass. So what's going on in the House right now?
Well, it's deathly quiet. We're in recess, subject to the call of the chair or the press. You know, the inside press is reporting that they're going to send back a bill that says that members of Congress and staff should not get any, should be thrown out of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan and should not receive any premium support in exchanges, and delaying the individual mandate for everybody by a year. Of course, delaying the individual mandate kills the ACA, because the only reason under this, you know, very complicated proposal, but the only way they were able to get the insurance industry to play along and sign up in the exchanges and offer reasonably, in fact, very well-priced policies in Oregon, I don't know about nationally in other states, is because they were going to get a group of people recruited who are going to be, you know, potentially absent to something catastrophic or an accident, young people, going to be people who are going to be paying modest premiums, but not drawing very heavily on them,
right.
And that's how they could do away with the pre-existing condition clause.
Right, so to get profitable customers.
The individual mandate, in all probability, the industry is going to say, to heck with this, we're not doing any, we're going back to pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, which, or you see health insurance companies actually start going out of business if the law requires them to continue to
Well, New York, insure people. You know, tried doing a mandatory coverage without the without the mandate, with, you know, precluding pre-existing conditions, and I mean premiums went through the roof.
Yeah. So isn't this just hot potato here? I mean, the House is going to pass a bill, then send it back to the Senate, and they're going to try and do it so that when that midnight witching hour happens, it's the Senate who's got the bill. You know, it's Harry Reid's hands who are holding the hot potato, right?
I think that's just a little too clever for the American public. I mean, I don't think the American public is going to be fooled by who was the last one to propose. You know, the Senate and Reid and the administration have been consistent, not bargaining or not being blackmailed. The House is just coming up with various demands. It's like a hostage negotiation, and they keep morphing their demands. So I don't think that's very good cover for them. I don't know who will end up holding the final bill, but, I mean, we could keep doing that all night. I mean, you could do it, say, let's keep going on. You know, let's just do this for the next, how long till the next election? 13 months. Let's vote 24 hours a day and throw it back and forth and blame each other and not have a government. I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, so now it would only take, if my math and recollection are correct, and you probably know this better than me, I think about 17 Republican votes along with all the Democrats could pass a clean continuing resolution?
Yeah, if everyone was present voting, yeah, that's what it would take. So you'd have to look for 17 rare Republicans who are either retiring or are in districts that are not deep red, where they would be petrified of a Tea Party primary.
Right.
There may be 17. Maybe. I mean, you know, they gerrymandered so much with redistricting that, like a 211 of their seats are, you know, except in some extraordinary wave, are not really contestable with the gerrymandering they did.
Wow. Even by the Tea Party.
Well, no. I mean, they're certainly contestable by the Tea Party in a primary. That's the whole point. But the D's, you know, are so disadvantaged in 211 districts that absent some extraordinary candidate or some big wave against the R's, you know, they got 211 solid seats.
Right.
That's a lot. You know, that means, you know, they've got 20 or 19 that aren't, which maybe, you know, maybe those 19 or 17 of those 19 would have the guts to, you know, withstand the threat. I mean, even Greg Walden from Oregon has a Tea Party opponent now because he hasn't been screaming enough on the floor about, you know.
You're kidding. Greg Walden is like, you know, vintage right wing. I mean,
he just picked one up on Friday because he's not right of the right wing. You know, it's amazing. But, I mean, no, he still believes in government, and that's enough to get you a primary. I mean, these are sort of radical anarchist libertarians or something. I don't know. There's no political category for the people we're dealing with here.
Well, actually, anarchists might actually describe them. I mean, if they genuinely believe what Ronald Reagan said in his first inaugural, you know, that government is not the solution to your problems, government is the problem, then it makes a lot of sense to shut down the government because, hey, it's the problem.
Right. No, it's
that's scary.
Amazing to listen to. And
it's like, you know, you consider the founders put their lives on, you know, 54 men signed their own death sentences with the Declaration of Independence to create this government. We fought a bloody war to create this government. We fought a civil war to keep this government. We fought two world wars to keep this government free. And now you've got guys in the United States House of Representatives saying they don't like this government. That sounds to me like anti-Americanism.
Yeah, there is a question. I did ask the question on the floor once during one of these debacles we've been having, you know, why, you know, my question was, why do they hate America so much? And anybody who's messing with the debt limit hates America, you know, because they're talking about really destructive action here. I mean, shutting down the government's one thing. Everyone understands that's, you know, pretty radical politics, but, you know, we survive it. But, you know, threatening to default unless what they put together is the most recent package I've seen is every radical bill that has passed the House since the Republicans took over in 2010. Most of which have never even seen the light of day in the Senate or been rejected by the Senate, would be appended to the debt limit, every single one. So what they're saying is a minority of the majority is now going to trump every other branch of government. They're going to run the United States of America from the minority of the majority in the House, trumping the courts and the administration and the Senate. It's pretty, I guess you could say it's revolutionary.
Yeah, yeah. Congressman Peter DeFazio, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And defazio.house.gov is Congressman DeFazio's website, defazio.house.gov. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Thank you very much for taking the call. You talk about these things, about the you make us aware of these things that are going on right now. But I watched Channel 4. CBS News in the morning, and there's a Nora O'Donnell who's talking about the upcoming crisis with the big crisis, which is
the debt ceiling.
Are we going to pay our debts?
Right.
And she said, and she slipped in the idea, are we going to make these structural changes? Now, that's an to me, I woke up. That's the introduction to, are we going to cut Social Security and Medicare?
Yes.
In order to pay off these debts. I heard this is in a byline, these guys have talked about this stuff for years.
Oh, ever since 1935.
Yeah, but it's getting even more rapid.
Yeah.
Well, more rabid, I should say.
Yeah. No, I agree, Frank, and I think you put your finger on it, and that's what Nora O'Donnell was talking about. And I don't know if she was pitching it or not, but a lot of people in the media are. And it's like, let's make structural changes. Well, fine. If you want to make structural changes, let's roll back the Reagan tax cut. You roll back the Reagan tax cut, and you eliminate the cap on Social Security. Just those two simple things, and, you know, we're fine. This country is fine, and we will pay off our debt, and everything will be fine. But instead, no, they want to stick it to poor people, elderly people, retired people, kids, hungry people, students. I mean, they're going to take it from anywhere they can other than going to rich people, and that's just tragic. Frank, thank you. You really nailed it. Wesley in Seattle. Hey, Wesley, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I think your previous caller should be aware of the fact that they intend to absolutely do away with Medicare completely. You know, that's what they're after. You know, it's become abundantly clear to me that liar Cantor and liar McConnell will destroy the American economy and blame it on this president.
Well, that's been their goal from, I mean, that was the plot that was hatched the night that Obama and President and Mrs. Obama were dancing at the inaugural balls.
Yes. I have a question, though, about, now, under the Constitution, this president has a right and the power and the responsibility, as far as I'm concerned, to maintain the good faith and credit of the United States.
Yes.
So he doesn't really have a choice but to unilaterally extend the debt ceiling if that becomes necessary.
I agree. I agree. Which would throw it, by the way, to the Supreme Court.
Well, we know how that'll work out, don't we?
Well, maybe not. I think that the Supreme Court would have to interpret this 1950s law that established Congress having to raise the debt ceiling to increase the borrowing power of Congress. I mean, this is relatively recent in American history, and the Supreme Court would have to compare that law, which is what we're all talking about here, the debt ceiling, versus the 14th Amendment saying that the full faith and credit of the United States shall not be questioned. And I don't know, but that Scalia may come down on the side of the full faith shall not be questioned. I suspect that if that got thrown to the monarchs in our constitutional monarchy, that they might rule on the side of government rather than the, as Congressman DeFazio described them, the people who hate America, these right-wing anarchists. So we'll see, Wesley. We'll see how it shakes out. Thanks a lot for the call and for raising the issue, though. Tanisha in Seattle. Hey, Tanisha, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I watch your show every day.
Thank you.
Here's my issue. Mm-hmm. It's like, first of all, I believe that Bush and Cheney set up the whole war issue with bin Laden. I believe that it was a setup by the United States in order to create war, because in war there's money. I believe that if you look at our society right now, there's like, it's incredible to where there's 78 people over the weekend dying in Chicago. They've cut food stamps. They're talking about women's issues as far as no abortions or abortions in certain cities or this, that, and the other. But then you turn around and say, okay, well, we're going to go on ahead and spend money the country that we're going to invade right now, Syria.
Yeah.
Okay. The whole time they're talking about chemical warfare and all that, and that's a bad thing. Yes, it is. But we have chemical warfare right here in the United States. We have hungry people. We have homeless people. We have people without any jobs.
Yeah.
And it's more or less like, how can you take care of somewhere else before you can take care of home?
Yep.
And nobody's looking at those issues like that. And then we have these people that are in our government who are supposed to be running the country, and they're not really running the country. They're running our lives to the fullest extent. And then not only that, but to turn around and say, okay, marijuana, for instance, we have marijuana in the equation now. But see, the thing about it is people don't look at it like this. As long as it's taxable, it's legal. If it's not taxable, then it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
The government is the most biggest drug dealers in the world. Anything that you have a problem with, they got a cure for it. Even if it's not effectively responsible for anything that happens to you, there's always a side effect or whatnot. It's like we're guinea pigs.
Yeah.
So what they're going through, and it's a messed up feeling as an American to say that I can't do what I want to do with my life because you want to hinder it. That's wrong.
Yeah, or somebody wants to make a buck off it. I mean, the major forces that are fighting the decriminalization of marijuana and that fought it tooth and nail, decriminalizing recreational marijuana in Washington State and Colorado, where it actually passed, were the alcohol lobbies and the tobacco lobbies. So, a good point. Tanisha, thank you. Good, great rant. Kirk in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for sharing this beautiful free air of our fifth estate with me. Sometimes when Dr. Boffer's on your show, he mentions that he believes that sometime in the middle of this decade that the economy will be transformed globally. And, you know, prior to hearing Representative Fazio, I thought that Republicans probably weren't crazy enough to blow up the debt ceiling. But after hearing Representative Fazio, maybe it is possible. I'm wondering whether That might be the transformative event that actually would change the global economy for the good, as painful as it would be.
It may well be, yeah. A giant crash brought about by billionaire-funded Tea Party primaries against sitting Republicans. Now that the House seats have been gerrymandered in, so that the Republicans basically have a permanent majority, even though in the last election more people voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than voted for Republicans, still you got Republicans controlling the House of Representatives. That's actually, Kirk, I got, you know, my new book coming out with the crash of 2012, or 2016 rather, that's a core premise of the book. And that this crash, you know, what I agree with Dr. Ravi Batra on this, that what will come out of this crash will be something good, just like what came out of the crash of 1929 was something good. It's just going to take some tough times to get there. Kirk, thanks for the call. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I got three quick topics. I promise I only want 60 seconds.
Okay.
But basically, to Tanisha, her thing about the Bush administration, you know, they had a plan. And basically, they brought us to war or not. I think part of the neocon thinking was, you know, they wanted something as big as World War II. Well, they've practically got it as far as the economy is concerned. Because just after World War II, the only country left standing that had any industry about itself was America. And that's when we actually became a superpower.
Yeah.
But in this case, we've become part of the collateral damage and the globalization
yep.
has taken over. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, Germany and Japan and, you know, rule the world now economically.
Exactly. So our corporations and our country has actually aided and benefited from that as well.
And who did we fight in World War II? Germany and Japan.
We fought the Germans. Exactly. And the thing about that as well, that's another part of my topic. These people that's you know, saving up their ammunition, these anarchists or whatever, what's the other words for them? The people that say, you know, if a bomb come and get their guns, they're going to go to war?
Yeah, I don't know. The libertarians, the anarchists, the,
yeah, okay.
You know.
Yeah, that's another preppers. That's the name I got from.
Oh, the preppers, the ones who are preparing for the end. Yeah, got it.
I got to remind them, that's the same kind of thinking that, as far as saving the motherland.
Yeah.
That pervaded through Germany in the early 30s and started this World War II. But at the end of World War II, who conquered them? The Allies conquered Germany. And the only people left standing was the kids, the young kids holding guns, and they couldn't even protect themselves. They got killed. So just remember that purpose. I mean, you know, you gotta think. You got to be on the right side. And last of all, as far as these Republicans and conservatives, yes, they want to shut down the government. That is their rhetoric from day one, because they want to progress. I mean, when they want to profess that government is the problem, guess what? It's actually going to backfire on them. All of these corporations and jobs that's cutting people on health care and cutting jobs, they're sending all of these people on the road to Obamacare. And, yes, they're going to want health care. People
yeah.
that didn't have.
I think you're right, Charles. I think you're absolutely right. Thanks a lot for the call. Good, another great rant. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the game of hot potato continues in the United States House of Representatives. John Boehner is going to send a bill back to the Senate, or is he going to pass the Senate bill that he's got? Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dean in Vail, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, or Dan, I'm sorry. Dan, what's up?
Oh, your guest earlier in the hour.
Congressman DeFazio.
Pardon?
Congressman DeFazio.
Right, yeah. Said he wished he had another term for the Tea Party. And I'd like to suggest Banana Republicans.
Huh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah, banana republics. You can't trust them to pay their bills. Their sovereign currency is worthless. Their debt is.
There are some good Republicans, and my best friend is one of them. But yeah, banana republicans is a good term for the other ones. And the genesis of that was this morning Harry Reid misspoke and sort of alluded to that term. So, and you know, in the news earlier, you talked about Reagan, well, you alluded to a Reagan joke. where the punchline was, I'm from the government, I'm here to help.
Right.
And I wanted to remind you of another thing that, Reagan said, and that was starve the beast.
Yeah.
And
that's what they're doing. Starve the government.
Doing
yep, that's absolutely what they're doing. Dan, excellent point. Thank you. Randall in Oakland, Tennessee. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hey, thank you, Tom. Woo, been waiting for a minute. Yeah, you're probably my favorite guy on the news right now.
Thank you.
Really enjoy your show. All right, I'm going to try to be as quick as possible so these other callers can get in.
Sure.
The mainstream media has got people really, really confused right now. I can't hardly understand it, Tom, because 1 week they're talking about this, the other week they're talking about that, and now you have a countdown to a shutdown. I don't even know what it is.
It's this really simple thing. Every 3 months or 6 months or a year, I mean, it's up to Congress how often they want to do it. They've got to vote to continue paying the government's bills to appropriate money to keep the government running. And then they also have to vote to raise the debt to borrow more money if they need to. And go ahead.
Why tell us about it?
Why what?
Why do they tell us about it?
Why do they tell us about it? They've got to do it. The Constitution says that all spending has to originate in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives is controlled by the Republicans. In order to continue spending, in order for the government to continue operating, the House of Representatives has to pass a piece of legislation called either a budget or a continuing resolution that funds the government, that gives money to the Treasury Department to pay the bills of the country. And they're saying, we will only do that if you will agree to cut back on Obamacare and to say that women can't get birth control with their insurance plans, to say that the Koch brothers' power plants and paper plants can put more pollution in the air, and the Keystone XL pipeline, TransCanada Corporation, a Canadian oil company, will get a whole bunch of money. These are like their demands,
yeah.
Right?
I want you to know I'm not no anti-government person. I'm a law-abiding citizen, but I will say I really wish the government would shut up or shut down or do whatever they're going to do. But I really have another question that concerns me a little bit. Why, Tom, is Obama – or no, I ain't going to say Obama because everybody, they're all in together. Why are they negotiating – with Iran?
With Iran?
Yes. Why would
to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon? The deal that they're making with Iran is, you don't build a nuclear weapon, and let us have inspectors in there, and let us see, let the whole world see that you're not doing that, and in exchange for that, we'll respect you and treat you like any other country in the world, and that's a reasonable deal, and that's actually a good thing.
It is time, but do you believe that that's going to help us in the future with Iran?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Iran's a big country, 76 million people. It's a modern, well-developed country.
What about our relationship with Israel? Do you think it will affect our relationship with Israel?
I don't think so. I really don't. Israel's a big boy and girl. I mean, Israel can take care of themselves. And if Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, that's one less thing that Israel has to worry about. So this is a good thing for Israel, too.
Good news, good news. Yeah, that's really what I wanted to get on here.
Okay. Randall, thanks a lot for the call. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. A quick word about the power of the word and the way Republicans seem to bend and twist language to their advantage. But first, I wanted to assure Tanisha that there are people out there that are dedicated to figuring out these issues behind closed doors. Unfortunately, they're the people that you find at make-believe think tanks like the Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, Heritage, whatever they call themselves, Club, the people that have that order catalog you can buy stuff from.
Right.
So, all the wrong people are dedicated to undermining the working man.
Yeah.
So anyway, and as
I agree.
Bob, we need more Texans like Bob. That's right. Tell everybody in Texas, especially in Texas, to move on, get over it. We've got real issues that need to be solved. And if they're too stupid to figure it out, let them resign and put some people in there that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tom, do you recall the use of the word knucklehead by President Obama?
No, I don't. I remember him.
This is several years now, I think, but this was following a bunch of what I would call the left-leaning liberals like myself who were advocating either for stopping Keystone XL or advocating for the implementation of universal health care with no insurance industry in the middle.
Right.
And his response was referring to us as knuckleheads. And I thought, okay, he wants to do that and endear himself to the people on the far right. Now he's earned some capital there, in other words, to use that same word to describe those knuckleheads, those extremists on the Republican side who are anti-government, anti-governance, who just want to stop up the works and make things harder for the working man.
Yeah. Well, knucklehead is a reasonable description. I don't recall him calling, Johnny, thank you for the call. I don't recall him calling us knuckleheads, but I know that, you know, there have been some strange things that have come out of the White House over the years. But, you know, no president is going to satisfy everybody. It's just, that's just simple reality. I'm very grateful that John McCain and Mitt Romney have never governed this country. It's a much better country for it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And some interesting goings on in the political scandal and politicians going to jail world. And we start with Tom DeLay, and we draw a parallel to that between that and Governor Don Siegelman, which, by the way, free-don.org is the website to learn all about Don Siegelman if you're not familiar with his situation. And, of course, bradblog.com. Brad Friedman, the founder, editor, and publisher of the Brad Blog, is with us. Hey, Brad, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, how are you? You mean there's other news going on other than the hostage-taking crisis in D.C.?
Well, we covered that for the first hour, so I wanted to talk about, you know, it's like enough already, right?
Yeah, right.
So, and I find this story fascinating. Tom DeLay was pretty much nakedly taking money from corporations and fat cats in Texas and using that money to pass along to other Republicans in the House. This is in order to get them to vote for him for Speaker of the House. This is, John Boehner does the same thing. I think he raised, what, $24 million last year, some amazing amount of money. And he's the largest funder of other Republicans in the House of Representatives from within the House of Representatives. And that's basically what the speaker does. But it turns out that that's illegal the way that he did it in Texas. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, I mean, what is different is that it is specifically illegal for corporations in Texas to give money to political candidates for office. They can give them to political action committees for, you know, administrative funds and so forth. But what Tom DeLay did back in 2002 was he accepted his PAC down there, accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars from corporate interests, which are not supposed to go to candidates. So what he did was he took that money and he gave it to an RNC, a National Political Action Committee, with the instructions that the RNC committee should give that money to seven specific candidates for office back in Texas. That, the prosecutors argued successfully, is money laundering. And Tom DeLay was found guilty in 2010 of two different counts of money laundering and was sentenced to about 8 years in jail. But then, of course, he was immediately released on bail and has never served a night in jail before two Republican judges about a week and a half ago reversed those charges, acquitted Tom DeLay, said that the corporations giving the money did so legally, therefore you can't consider it money laundering. It was, you know, sort of this tortured logic that the two Republicans on this three-judge panel voted for. The Democrat dissented, but for now, at least, it has allowed Tom DeLay to get off scot-free without spending a night in jail.
Which brings us now, Tom DeLay, of course, was one of if not the most powerful Republican in the United States, and in fact, he had the nickname the Hammer. Which brings us to Don Siegelman, who is a Democrat and was the governor of Alabama.
Yeah.
Or Arkansas. No, which one?
Yeah.
Arkansas.
Alabama.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And Don Siegelman, tell us the story.
Yeah, well, so you can contrast Tom DeLay's case because his case, by the way, was very successful. The Texan who were running for the legislatures were elected. They were then able to for the first time since Reconstruction, by the way, the Republicans ended up taking a majority of the Texas State House. They were able to gerrymander Texas, and the result was 5 additional Republicans in the U.S. House. So it was a scheme that was very successful for Tom DeLay, who became the Republican majority leader. Contrast that with Don Siegelman, who received nothing of personal gain in what he was charged with, charges related to what they call bribery, but 113 bipartisan former state's attorney general have sent a note saying, to the Supreme Court saying this was not a crime. What Siegelman was charged with was never a crime before in the history of this country. There was no quid pro quo. He received no personal benefit from this money that was given by a sort of a campaign contributor. A contributor gave money to a lottery campaign that Siegelman was in favor of that would send poor kids to school for free.
Which a lot of states do. I used to live in Georgia, and they have a scholarship fund that's funded with the lottery.
Exactly, and that's what Siegelman was pushing for. He was in favor of it. This businessman contributed a lot of money to that fund, and what they claim that this guy got in return was that he was allowed to be on a state hospital board. But the fact of the matter is, it was a voluntary hospital board. In other words, he was not paid for this position, and he had been appointed to that very same position by 3 previous governors, previous Republican governors.
Right.
So there was really nothing, apparently, that Siegelman got in exchange.
So Don Siegelman committed no crime, and yet he is in prison as you and I are speaking right now. Yep. Tom DeLay committed an obvious crime, and yet he has never served a day in jail.
6.5 years is what Don Siegelman is currently serving, and he has charged a massive conspiracy that Tom DeLay was involved in to steal his 2002 election, and then later on to prosecute him and put him in jail, along with guys like Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff and so forth. And there is a great deal of evidence to show that that is exactly what happened, including that stolen election, by the way, which he went to bed in 2002 having been reelected, announced by all the networks as having been the winner of that election, only to find out the next day that, what do you know, a Diebold tabulator in one little county in Alabama suddenly discovered 5,000 votes that they hadn't seen previously. It changed the results of the election for governor, didn't change any other votes across the state, but it did change the governor's election, and he was tossed out. He was a very popular Democratic governor. And that was something that, you just can't have in a southern state.
And the guy he ran against, Bob Riley,
yep.
Who is now the governor of Alabama, or was until recently. I think he still is, isn't he?
I think he still is.
Yeah. The guy he ran against, Bob Riley, his campaign manager,
right?
who Mr. Canary, what was his first name?
Laura Canary and Bill Canary. Yeah,
Bill Canary. His campaign manager, Bill Canary, was Karl Rove's best friend from college days. And his wife, the campaign manager for Bob Riley, for Don Siegelman's Republican opponent, the campaign manager's wife was the federal prosecutor in Alabama, appointed by, I believe, George W. Bush,
yes,
who prosecuted Don Siegelman.
That's correct. I mean, an unbelievable conflict of interest. And by the way, as the case proceeded, the judges that oversaw the case were also clients of Karl Rove. So you have, the prosecutor married to the campaign chief of Don Siegelman's rival. I mean, it's an extraordinary case of injustice as far as I can see. And yet Siegelman's still in jail. Tom DeLay is walking free. Ted Stevens, you remember, similarly was let off the hook as soon as the Obama administration came to office because of prosecutorial misconduct. But in this case, there seems to be no action whatsoever other than the Department of Justice trying to get a stronger sentence against Don Siegelman. It is just outrageous, Tom.
Outrageous is not a strong enough word. It's anti-American. It is. Right. It's the kind of thing you would expect to see in a banana republic. It's the kind of thing that you would expect to see. I mean, this is the kind of criminal justice system that North Korea has. This makes no sense.
It really is. And this is something that we got a statement at bradblog.com from the governor from jail following Tom DeLay's getting off the hook. And I'll tell you, he's fighting mad about it. You can read that at bradblog.com. And I hope people will speak out for a pardon for this man because it is outrageous.
Amen. Contact the president. Contact the White House. Pardon Don Siegelman. Bradblog.com. Brad Friedman. Thanks, Brad.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a moment. We can continue to discuss what the Republicans are up to. The situation is developing by the minute. This is really, really interesting. By the way, I believe it was Charles called me a minute ago and said, how much does it cost Congress to run? And Danielle checked this during the apparently while I was on the air, and she said, according to the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Oh, and also a shout out to Jacob Dean, by the way, who's helping out today. And hey, Jacob, great to be working with you again. But according to Think Progress, the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, when at the point that the House had voted to repeal Obamacare 37 times, they had spent $55 million. So they probably spent close to $60 million so far. Basically doing these political stunts, what I referred to a few minutes ago as political masturbation. It is terrible. And now what's happening, and this is where it gets really interesting, is the right-wingers in the House are trying to come up with things that they can attach to a bill to defund Obamacare that they think will get a lot of publicity. You know, this is an old Republican strategy. It's like pass legislation. This goes back to Newt Gingrich's contract with America, right? Pass legislation that people think is going to have something to do with improving the quality of their life or reducing the number of abortions or making sure that, you know, the crime rates go down or improving education. Pass something that seems like it's, you know, some kind of moral high ground when, in fact, all you're trying to do is make rich people richer and wipe out the middle class. So the stunt part of this that the Republicans are debating right now in the House of Representatives with themselves is saying, okay, we got to pass another law tonight, another continuing resolution, another bill that will fund the government, and we've got to pass it before midnight and get it to the Senate so that this hot potato will leave our hands and be in Harry Reid's hands when the clock runs out at midnight. And it's going to be very interesting to see how Harry Reid handles this, whether he just ignores it and says, I'm tired of playing with these children. You know, if you're going to do that to yourself, go do it in your own bedroom. Close the door, please. You know, that kind of thing. Or whether Harry Reid says, okay, cool, we'll just vote on it. 54 to 46, bang, back to you, John. Here you go. But anyhow, what they're trying to add into this thing is language that would deny Obamacare benefits to employees of members of the House of Representatives and to members of the House of Representatives themselves, members of Congress. Now, in the Senate is called the Millionaires Club. There's, you know, I don't think Bernie Sanders is a millionaire. I'm pretty sure Sherrod Brown isn't. But most of the guys in the Senate are millionaires. Most of the men and women there are multimillionaires. They don't care. I mean, they do care, but it's not going to hurt them. But the House of Representatives, I mean, the richest guy in the House of Representatives is Darrell Issa. And he's worth about $700 million, I believe. but there's only 100 and some odd members, fewer than 200 out of the 435, who are millionaires, who are even worth more than $1 million in the House of Representatives. So there's a number of people in the House of Representatives who are just basically working stiffs. Now, $186,000 ain't chicken feed as annual pay, but you do have to maintain a residence in D.C. plus, you know, back home in Missouri or wherever it may be. And there are a lot of expenses associated with being a member of Congress. So it's not, I mean, you know, I've seen how some of these folks live, and they're not living high. At least many of them. And so here's the language from the New York Times article, which is fascinating. The language would put poorly paid junior staff members, this is members of the House of Representatives, staff members, junior staff members at a disadvantage. Most people buying coverage on the exchanges will receive subsidies through generous tax credits. Most Americans will still get their insurance from their employers, but will continue to receive a tax deduction for the cost of that care. Under the House language, however, lawmakers and their staffs, executive branch political appointees, the White House staff, as well as the vice president and the president, would have to pay the entire cost of health insurance out of their pockets. So it's not tax deductible, and they actually have to write a check for their own health insurance, go out and buy a plan. No Obamacare for you. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Congressman Chris Stewart, Republican of Utah, said members were standing, in other words, Republican congressmen are standing, literally standing up on the floor of the House or standing up in the Republican caucus room where they're having this debate, were standing to say that they had sick children who would be hard to insure, or they themselves would struggle to buy insurance either because of their age or their health conditions, pre-existing conditions. This is a Republican. Congressman Chris Stewart of Utah. So Congressman Bill Schuster, Republican of Pennsylvania, says there are definitely some people who are not very much for it. We'll see what happens on the floor tonight. And Peter King, the Republican congressman from New York, said that his junior staff members were being sacrificed, his words, sacrificed for a political gambit, is the language used in the New York Times in this article today by Ashley Parker. Very, very well-written piece. So won't that be interesting? If the Republicans can't even get their own caucus to vote on their own amendment to the continuing resolution to fund the government that they intend to be the hot potato that they're going to throw at Harry Reid at the Senate, it's, in a way, kind of sad, you know, that these guys would fight so hard to make sure that you and I can't get reasonably priced health insurance. It's like the fight of their lifetimes. It's really kind of sad when you think about it. It's a sad commentary on the state of this nation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's a sad commentary on the state of this nation that the billionaires, particularly the Koch brothers, who helped put most of these Tea Party Republicans in office, they don't care about health insurance. Very interesting. So the Republicans, they're basically saying, you know, before they were saying, if you don't put through the Keystone XL pipeline so the Koch brothers can make millions of dollars down in the, you know, refining Canadian oil and shipping it to China, if you don't do that, if you don't cut back on EPA rules so the Koch brothers can dump more poisons in the air from their factories and their refineries, if you don't do that, if you don't deregulate the banks a little more, do away with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau so our buddies on Wall Street can make billions, if you don't do that, we're going to shoot the American people. We're going to shut down the government. We're going to lay off 800,000 people. We're going to throw their families into poverty, put them on unemployment. We're going to destroy people's lives. That's what they said. We're going to hurt. They said that they were going to hurt us, right? The Republicans said that they were going to hurt the American people. Now the Republicans are planning, and I don't know, you know, I frankly would be surprised if they succeed in pulling this thing off. But it appears that what they're planning to do is say, not only if we don't get the stuff we want, especially delaying Obamacare, not only are we going to shoot the hostage of the American people, we're going to shoot ourselves. It's like, you know, what was it, Cleavon Little in Blazing Saddles? I mean, putting the gun to his own head. Look out, I'll shoot. I mean, they're going to, the Republicans are saying that if they don't get their way, well, actually, if they do get their way, they're going to shoot themselves. That's what they're proposing. It's bizarre. I mean, it's just bizarre. Nancy in Chicago. Hey, Nancy, what do you make of this?
Hi, Tom. I've been thinking that this comes under the category, I would think, for making a charge of domestic treason or sedition. No one uses that term, but these right-wing radicals are really engaging in seditious activity. They're trying to undermine the effectiveness of our government.
You know, I've been for weeks pushing back against people using those kind of words because I think that I don't want those words diluted. You know, I just like the same reason you don't make comparisons to the Holocaust. You don't want that, you know, the reality, the horrible power of that word to be diluted by overuse. But sedition, maybe. I wouldn't go to treason, but sedition, I'm going to have to look up the dictionary definition. But I think you may be onto something, Nancy. I mean, there has to, at its core, what these guys are arguing, what these men and women are arguing, and Michelle Bachmann is giddy about this. Oh, boy, we're going to shut down the government. She who is being investigated for criminal activity, she who took millions of dollars in farm bill subsidies because she owns a farm and yet voted for a farm bill that continued her subsidies but cut off food stamps to poor children. She is so excited about this. She apparently cut a deal with the prosecutors to not run for Congress again to maybe avoid prosecution. We'll see. But sedition could be, Nancy. Certainly. Yeah, go ahead.
The definition of sedition, if you do look it up, okay. One of the definitions is to actively seek to undermine the effectiveness of the government. And I would say this is what they are doing.
This is seditious activity. Nancy, thank you for sharing that. I believe you. Mike in South Deerfield, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Had a situation evolve this past week that I'm sure many, many, many progressives have faced, and I thought maybe you would have some sage advice for us. We've gotten hundreds of emails from various progressive outlets looking for money before the deadline tonight to try to counter the billionaires right. on the other side.
Right.
You and I and 100,000 of our closest friends could give until we totally disrupted our family budgets and fortunes, and it wouldn't make any difference. What's the answer?
I on the one hand, I would say, you know, if you've got 10 or 20 bucks and there's one of these organizations, I mean, the Campaign for America's Future is very active in this. OurFuture.org is their website. Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org. There's a bunch of good organizations that are doing good work, and you want to toss some money their way, I would not counsel you not to. But my experience, having watched this process since I was a teenager and watching my father in this process as well of political activism and watching political change, has been that the single most effective way a person can help be an agent of change is by finding that one narrow slice of activity about which you feel the most passionate? What is the thing that you really care about? Do you care, you know, is it the empowerment of women or the education of girls? Is it family planning or birth control? Is it gun control? Is it amending the United States Constitution to take money out of politics? Is it health care instead of warfare? Find that one issue that you would commit your life to and then do it. Commit your life to it. And find the organization that does the best job of standing with that issue. Is that issue stopping global warming? Is that issue stopping the crazy behavior on the part of the Republican Party? Whatever it may be. And spend some time filtering these organizations, looking at their websites, talking to their people, looking through their literature, looking at their tax filings and seeing, you know, how much of their money is actually going to what they're doing, seeing how, you know, how much they are grassroots and versus how much they're more institutional or something like that, and
as usual you make a very elegant argument, and I don't disagree with any part of it. But what about the more general question raised by the people who are saying you have to give to us because we have to counter this flood of money coming from the other side?
Yeah. If they are organizations, well, like I said, if you've got 10 or 20 bucks to toss their way right now, and it's an organization that you know and respect, I would do it. I mean, I've given money recently to several of these progressive organizations, and because we all need to pitch in, and there are also media organizations as well. Free Speech TV is in a fund drive right now. A lot of our Pacifica radio stations are in fund drives, and if you're listening on a commercial progressive station, and you are WHMP, yeah, just calling their sponsors and telling them that you're listening is a way that strengthens that media, and that can have as much impact as sending $10 to an organization. But beyond that, I don't have an easy answer, Mike. I mean, the answer in my mind of how do you counter the billionaires' money is you allow Congress to pass laws eliminating the billionaires' money, which Congress has done in the past. Republicans and Democrats together agree on this. McCain-Feingold was totally bipartisan. The Supreme Court knocked it down. The only way to get money out of politics is to amend the Constitution to say that this Supreme Court-invented doctrine of corporations as persons and money as speech is wrong. And the one organization that is doing the very best work on that, and there's a dozen of them out there, and I encourage you to check them all out, but the one that I think is doing the very best work is run by David Cobb, who ran for president of the Green Party a while back, and it's called Move to Amend, movetoamend.org. If you're really concerned with countering the billionaires, be in the long game, not just the short game. You know, send something to the people who are standing up right now, but also, you know, with movetoamend.org, that's a large national grassroots volunteer group, and I don't know the percentages, but it wouldn't surprise me if a large percentage of the people who participate don't give them money, they give them time. They've got, you know, the chapters, hundreds of chapters all over the United States, and every single one started in somebody's kitchen or their living room. And so, you know, that would be my personal, that's my personal passion. That's, I mean, I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection. That's where I would start. But,
thank you, as always, for your thoughts. And more generally, thank you for giving us hope every day by informing us, and especially with regard to the history and the various other more subtle aspects of so many of these topics that no one else gives us. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mike, for your kind words. And thanks for listening to WHMP. Mike in Delano, Minnesota. We got a minute to the break, Mike. It's yours. You want to talk about your Congresswoman Bachman?
Right. I called her office and told them what the savings would be with MenCare, the health exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the problem they have and Michelle Bachman has is the individual mandate. And why should 300 million people be forced to do something that would allow me to have health insurance? And I thought I told her I'm speechless at that remark.
You're speechless because you don't know the answer. You're speechless because it's such a stupid question.
I said that she would say something like that to a constituent.
Yeah, yeah. It's like either we're all Isn't the fundamental idea of America, you know what I would have said to her, is isn't the fundamental of idea of America that the founders created is that we're all in this thing together? I mean, Ben Franklin at the
law.
Yeah, what Ben Franklin said when they signed the Declaration of Independence, we must hang together or surely we shall hang separately. And it's true of healthcare as well. We are all in this together. I mean, if we're going to pay, thanks, Mike. If we're going to pay collectively for the fire department, and we all agree on this, to put out our house when it catches on fire, why shouldn't we pay collectively to put out our bodies when they catch on fire?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, obviously, that's a metaphor. I'm not talking about spontaneous combustion. I'm talking about diseases and cancers and things. But it's the same thing. It's a crisis. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The president may be speaking soon. If he does, we will probably carry parts of that, if not all of that, live on our show here. So we'll see what happens. For the moment, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Tom. Yes, we are moments away from the president scheduled to speak about 5 minutes ago. We're just running a very few minutes late. Don't know when he's going to come out into the Brady Press briefing room and talk about, we imagine, the impending government shutdown, which could still be averted with 7 hours to go, but looking increasingly less likely after the Senate today, little after 2, sent back a clean continuing resolution to the House of Representatives. Then the Republicans in the House apparently going to try to pass a bill that would delay the mandate that individuals buy health insurance and would cancel health insurance subsidies for members of Congress, staff, the president, and administration appointees. Those provisions would be attached to a government funding bill, almost certain to be rejected by the Senate because they've said, the Democrats in the Senate have said they will have only a clean continuing resolution, particularly with 7 hours to go, the idea that mandates that individuals buy health insurance being canceled just before you're going to have open enrollment of Obamacare is just something that is simply not going to fly.
Amazing. Amazing. We just lost your video, Victoria, but we can still talk to you. We can still talk to you just fine. And reading the New York Times has an interesting piece on this, and it points out that Congressman Chris Stewart, a Republican of Utah, said that during the debates on this, in other words, let's cut off Obamacare to our staff members, that there were members of the House of Representatives, Republican congressmen, who were standing up and saying that, quote, they themselves would struggle to buy insurance either because of their age or their health conditions, and others who said that they had sick children who would be hard to insure. I mean, is it possible that John Boehner can't even get a majority of his own caucus or enough of his own caucus to vote for this that he can get it passed through the House?
You know, it's a really weird situation that he's got, because you've got a situation where you've got possibly, I'm hearing, maybe 60 really strong Tea Partyites who are sort of rowing the boat right now. And then you've got other Republican congressmen who are basically saying things like this. And who would they be willing to vote with Democrats? I don't know. But who certainly quietly are saying things like that and who feel quite differently, but don't, I think, feel strongly enough to, or not that they don't feel strongly enough, are just simply overridden by the passions, vocal passions of the Tea Partyites.
Right, and they're also afraid that, we talked with Congressman DeFazio about this earlier, and he said most of these guys are just scared to death that they will have a Tea Party primary.
And they probably will.
Yeah. Whether or not they go along with this. But, I mean, if John Boehner, he's got a clean bill right now. The Senate sent him a clean continuing resolution. All he has to do is bring it to the floor for a vote. And I would think it's a virtual certainty that with all of the Democrats, it would only take 17 Republicans to vote for it, and it would pass. And there's Congressman DeFazio said there's about 23 Republicans who are in districts that are sufficiently solid that there's that there's they don't have to worry about the Tea Party.
Oh, I think that's the case. On my Twitter feed, I've already seen tweets from saying indicating that John Boehner will not do that, that there's not going to be a clean CR.
And this is because he has his own Tea Party challenger now, right?
Indeed, and he also wants to hang on to the speakership. Everybody has an agenda here.
So John Boehner is going to take the country down so that he can continue to hold power.
That's a piece of it. Now, meantime, coming in with the cavalry, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who we haven't heard a peep from, he's, of course, being primaried next year, is proposing, apparently, a one-week clean continuing resolution so that all the parties can talk. But even that is not getting support from the restive Republican caucus. Because, and even from some Democrats, because some Democrats are saying, look, there's a simple solution. Pass the bill that's over there, Senator Chuck Schumer is saying, just get it done. But some Republicans are saying, come on. House Republicans are saying, that's not enough. We just want to get on with our thing, too. But that's his proposal.
Right. It's pretty amazing.
By time.
It's pretty amazing when you think about it. I mean, it's genuinely astounding, in fact. What else is going on in the world?
Well, you'd be astonished that there are other things going on in the world. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C., met with the president in the Oval Office today, and pushed him on Iran, over which he is concerned. He's concerned that the president is going to give away the store, basically, because of President Hassan Rouhani's charm offensive. And pressed him to step up sanctions on Iran if it pursues its disputed nuclear drive. Now, Obama said that Tehran has to prove its sincerity with actions. He insisted that D.C. would not ease sanctions prematurely. He also said all options are on the table. In other words, he reaffirmed U.S. readiness to resort to military action if all else fails. Netanyahu speaks at the U.N. General Assembly tomorrow. He will apparently provide new information that the Israelis have about Iran's military nuclear program.
Military as in building a bomb?
As in building a bomb, yes.
How do they do that when their own supreme leader has issued a fatwa saying that building a bomb is anti-Islam?
Astonishing.
That's sort of like saying, you know, that they're using birth control inside the Vatican.
Astonishing.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that fatwa is serious, or do you think that it's posturing?
I don't trust Ayatollah Khamenei round the corner.
I see. Yeah. Well, there's something to be said for that, I suppose. Victoria, I don't know the guy. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Go to theoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. For this hour, Wendell Potter is going to be with us taking your calls and questions about the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. Because tomorrow is the day that you can start signing up, and I know a lot of people have a lot of questions. However, the President of the United States is speaking right now about the government shutdown. Let's go to that and hear what he has to say.
Of the government to ideological demands like limiting a woman's access to contraception or delaying the Affordable Care Act, all to save face after making some impossible promises to the extreme right wing of their party. So let me be clear about this. An important part of the Affordable Care Act takes effect tomorrow, no matter what Congress decides to do today. The Affordable Care Act is moving forward. That funding is already in place. You can't shut it down. This is a law that passed both houses of Congress, a law that bears my signature, a law that the Supreme Court upheld as constitutional, a law that voters chose not to repeal last November, a law that is already providing benefits to millions of Americans in the form of young people staying on their parents' plan until they're 26, seniors getting cheaper prescription drugs, making sure that insurance companies aren't imposing lifetime limits when you already have health insurance, providing rebates for consumers when insurance companies are spending too much money on overhead instead of health care. Those things are already happening. Starting tomorrow, tens of millions of Americans will be able to visit healthcare.gov to shop for affordable health care coverage. So Americans who've lived 4 years in some cases with the fear that one illness could send them into bankruptcy, Americans who've been priced out of the market just because they've been sick once, they'll finally be able to afford coverage, quality coverage, many of them for the first time in their lives. Some of them may be sick as we speak. And this is their best opportunity to get some security and some relief. Tens of thousands of Americans die every single year because they don't have access to affordable health care. Despite this, Republicans have said that if we lock these Americans out of affordable health care for one more year, if we sacrifice the health care of millions of Americans, then they'll fund the government for a couple of more months. Does anybody truly believe that we won't have this fight again in a couple of more months? Even at Christmas? So here's the bottom line. I'm always willing to work with anyone of either party to make sure the Affordable Care Act works better, to make sure our government works better. I'm always willing to work with anyone to grow our economy faster or to create new jobs faster, to get our fiscal house in order for the long run. I've demonstrated this time and time again, oftentimes to the consternation of my own party. But one faction of one party in one House of Congress, in one branch of government, doesn't get to shut down the entire government just to refight the results of an election. Keeping the people's government open is not a concession to me. Keeping vital services running and hundreds of thousands of Americans on the job is not something you give to the other side. It's our basic responsibility. It's something that we're doing for our military and our businesses and our economy and all the hard-working people out there, the person working for the agricultural department out in some rural community who's out there helping some farmers make sure that they're making some modest profit for all the hard work they're putting in. They're the person working for HUD who's helping somebody buy a house for the first time. There's somebody in a VA office who's counseling one of our vets who's got PTSD. That's who we're here to serve. That's why we're supposed to be carrying out these responsibilities. That's why we should be avoiding this kinds of constant brinksmanship. It's something that we do in the ordinary process of this extraordinary system of government that we have. You don't get to extract a ransom for doing your job, for doing what you're supposed to be doing anyway, or just because there's a law there that you don't like. The American people sent us here to govern. They sent us here to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make their lives a little bit better, to create new jobs, to restore economic security, to rebuild the prospects of upward mobility. That's what they expect. And they understand that there are differences between the parties. And we're going to be having some tough fights around those differences. And I respect the fact that the other party is not supposed to agree with me 100% of the time, just like I don't agree with them. But they do also expect that we don't bring the entire government to a halt or the entire economy to a halt just because of those differences. And that's what they deserve. They've worked too hard for too long to recover from previous crises just to have folks here in Washington manufacture yet another one that they have to dig themselves out of. So Congress needs to keep our government open. needs to pay our bills on time and never, ever threaten the full faith and credit of the United States of America. And time's running out. My hope and expectation is that in the 11th hour, once again, that Congress will choose to do the right thing, and that the House of Representatives in particular will choose the right thing. Thank you very much.
There you go. Welcome back. And so that's the President of the United States speaking on health care and the shutdown that has been precipitated by the Republicans. I mean, just essentially the Republicans' hatred of the idea that working class and working poor Americans might be able to get health insurance. That's what it comes down to. Wendell Potter is with us. He's an insurance industry whistleblower, former senior executive with one of the big insurance companies, the author of a book, Deadly Spin. His website, Wendell Potter, 1D, 2 L's, 2 T's, WendellPotter.com, and Twitter, at Wendell Potter. Wendell, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me back.
Thanks for joining us. And let me just tell all of our listeners, after the break, we got about a minute of the break here, we will be taking calls for Wendell if you have any questions about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. I'm curious your thoughts on what the president just had to say.
Well, obviously the president was correct. The Affordable Care Act will go forward, regardless of what happens or doesn't happen in Congress today or tomorrow or next week. The health insurance marketplaces will open tomorrow as scheduled, and the new rules of the healthcare system are taking place. A lot of people already have benefited. At least 100 million Americans already have benefited from the Affordable Care Act. Millions more will in the coming weeks and months.
So, it's, just to be clear, the Obamacare, in quotes, is not subject to a government shutdown. If the government shuts down, people who might help you sign up for Obamacare, they still have their jobs because their part of the government is funded?
That's right. In fact, as he said, most of the Affordable Care Act has already been paid for. It's already funded. It's been in the system, and a lot of the money has been spent. And it will go forward. What this might affect are some government workers who do work that's entirely unrelated to the Affordable Care Act. Many of them will be furloughed. But the Affordable Care Act, that's what the supreme irony here is, that yes, some parts of the government could be shut down, but Obamacare would go forward.
Yeah, that is ironic. Wendell Potter's with us. We'll be back with more of your, we'll start out with your calls. If you have a question about Obamacare, anything about this law that you don't understand, give us a call at 1-866-987-THOM, and Wendell Potter will be glad to answer them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, we'll be back with Wendell Potter, WendellPotter.com, commenting on the Affordable Care Act and answering your questions. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Wendell Potter on the line with us. The famous, you were a vice president, weren't you, Wendell?
That's right.
Yeah,
with
was it Aetna?
It was Cigna and Humana before that.
Cigna and Humana. Senior executive with a couple of major health insurance companies. You really know this business from the inside out. You wrote a book called Deadly Spin, blowing the whistle on the practices of this industry. And you know what's going on with Obamacare. So, first of all, starting tomorrow is open enrollment, and that runs from tomorrow, October 1st, until March 31st, if I have that right.
That's right.
And
that's
so that's a six-month period in which you can enroll. What happens if you got Republicans out here saying to young people, don't enroll in that program. And what happens if they listen to that siren song after March 31st, and then maybe in April or May of next year, God forbid, they discover that they've got, a lump someplace, or they're not feeling well or whatever, and they decide, maybe I better get some insurance. Can they do it?
Well, they may have they might be able to get it outside of the exchange. It won't be that will be the only place where you can get coverage, but they might have some difficulty getting it. And here's the reason why. You don't want people to wait until they know that they've they've got an illness or an injury to sign up. That would create what's referred to as adverse selection or a death spiral. You've got to make sure you've got people enrolled and understand the rules of enrollment so that they don't wait until they get sick. It has to be that way. Otherwise, the insurance companies just simply wouldn't participate in the program.
So is it going to be a six-month open enrollment period every year and then 6 months where the window closes?
I think we'll see if that remains to be the case. I think there may be some changes, maybe some flexibility. That window may narrow, or it could stay the same, or it could be widened. But this is the first time, obviously, that this has ever been done, and I think that the Department of Health and Human Services and the state government, the governments, the regulators will be looking at this to see how well it worked and whether it needs to be tweaked in the future.
Right. Okay. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Dan in Tell City, Indiana. You're on the air with Wendell Potter, Dan.
Okay. My question is, if Indiana doesn't have any health care exchanges because of the Republican governors, where can I find out about the affordable health care benefits?
I'm really glad you asked that, because a lot of people are confused about what their states have done. States have the option of not expanding the Medicaid program in their states, and about half the states have decided not to do that. But every state, including Indiana, including Florida and Texas, and some of the other states that are not expanding their Medicaid programs right now, every state and the District of Columbia will have an exchange up and running, and it will go live after midnight tonight. So if you live in Indiana and you want to shop for coverage tomorrow, you'll be able to, regardless of what your governor and legislature has to say. The federal government will be operating the exchanges for a lot of states. And I've heard that from a lot of people, by the way, that they've gotten confused because some states have not expanded their Medicaid programs to 2014, but that has nothing to do with the exchanges or the marketplaces.
So he should go to what, healthcare.gov, and it'll direct him to the place in Indiana where he can find the exchange?
Exactly. I think it'll be seamless for most people. You can go to healthcare.gov. You just click on the drop-down menu to indicate where you live, and then just go from there.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Coy in Land O'Lakes, Florida. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Greetings, Wendell Potter and Tom. It's wonderful to be on the air. I have a question that I'm trying to get a clear and concise answer to. First, let's start. Wendell, you have read the legislation, correct?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So could you tell us what enforcement mechanism is in place and what its maximum penalty is for the insurance company that denies you coverage that you are entitled to, that you paid for?
Well, you know, it depends on how well this will be enforced. Will depend on the willingness and the resources of the states, because state governments, through their insurance departments, are responsible for the regulation of health insurance, at least health insurance that's bought by individuals. And it depends, again, on the resources and the willingness of those regulators to do that. Now, there will be penalties for noncompliance. Will the regulators enforce that? Remains to be seen. I think some states will be more vigilant than others. The penalties can be significant. It could be $100 per infraction, per member, per day. So it can add up very quickly for an insurance company.
For an insurance company with millions of customers, $100 per customer can be hundreds of millions of dollars, in other words.
Yeah, over time it can be a big fine. So I think that there will be incentive for insurance companies to comply with the law. Okay. They'll want to. Bottom line, they often walk up to the line of what is legal, what's permitted. In some cases, they'll go over it, but they don't want to get slapped with a fine of any kind because of the potential for bad publicity as well.
Right. Patsy in Kyles Ford, Tennessee. We just have a minute to the break, Patsy, if it's a quick question.
Yes, I wanted to know, in Tennessee, I went to the website. They say that they're not offering this yet, the affordable health care. And I understood the answer just a few minutes ago, but I want to know, can seniors be involved in this affordable health care, and would it lower our costs? I have been using different supplemental health care insurance, but I wanted to know about that.
Thank you, Patsy.
Well, thank you, Patsy, and I'm a Tennessean myself. And, yes, Tennesseans, just like the folks in Indiana, will have an exchange, and they, you can go to healthcare.gov, and you can find choices in Tennessee. Senior citizens are benefiting already if you're enrolled. If you are Medicare eligible, and I expect that you are, if you get a Medicare supplement policy, already you have some benefits available to you. You can get preventive.
Let's get into the details of that right after the break. Okay, Wendell? Wendell Potter with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back right after the news at the bottom of the hour with more with Wendell Potter, health insurance industry whistleblower, author of Deadly Spin, WendellPotter.com. We'll be back in 6 minutes with Wendell. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Indeed, that's what we do. Wendell Potter is on the line with us, insurance industry whistleblower, author of the book Deadly Spin. His website, WendellPotter.com. His Twitter feed is at Wendell Potter, WendellPotter. And Wendell, you're still with us. I see you there. So let's pick up some phone calls here. Tom in Chicago, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Yes, hello. I got a quick question with regards to the Affordable Care Act. Specifically, my wife works and has health insurance. She has epilepsy, so our premium is kind of high, like $900 a month, and I'm on her policy, you know, as, you know, her husband. My question is, and I'm a small business owner, and I have no employees or anything like that, so is it better for me to have my own policy and then her policy change? And I'm just trying to see from a financial standpoint.
You know, you might check that out starting tomorrow to find out what would be the cost for you and your wife. As a small business owner, you certainly can shop for coverage starting tomorrow because the exchanges, the marketplaces will be open to individuals and small businesses. So you might be able to get a better deal. I definitely would check it out and look at the various options that will be available to you.
Now, I understand, Wendell, that if you have health insurance right now through your employer, that you can't drop that to pick up Obamacare. But if his wife dropped her health insurance and he got Obamacare and put her on as a dependent, does that work? Is that Could it be done that way?
I think that would work, and you could certainly query the website or talk to a navigator to find out. But
right.
I think that would work. I mean, if you are a small business owner and you can look to see if you can get coverage, it might be that you could do that.
Okay, Josh in Fort Collins, Colorado, listening on AM 750. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Hey, Wendell and Tom, how are you guys?
Great.
How are you doing?
My question is, as it pertains to the Affordable Care Act, I see how it improves access. What I don't understand is how it makes the whole bucket of health care for everybody more affordable. I guess my issue is it does, you know, my opinion, the underlying problem with health care is sort of our lifestyle in this country, whether it's diabetes, metabolic syndrome, childhood diabetes, and it doesn't do anything to start to address those issues, which really reduce the cost of healthcare. So I'm trying to separate access versus affordability.
You know, the Affordable Care Act does do things. It's a big law, and most people have been focused, understandably, on the changes to the health insurance component of that, and I have too. But there are other provisions of the law that address wellness and prevention and the underlying cost of care. That said, I think, and I've often said, that the Affordable Care Act is the end of the beginning of reform. I think we'll see that there will be a lot of other efforts, many of the efforts coming from the private sector to try to address those underlying causes. But also know that some of the new health plans that are going to be available will be working specifically on that. There's a health plan in Tennessee, for example, one of the new co-ops that's going to be focusing on wellness. It's just part of the DNA of the health plan, as they call it, and they'll be from the very beginning working individually with their members to try to make sure that they get in touch with a primary care physician, do certain things and they'll have to do certain things to in terms of diet and fitness and health to be able to stay on the health plan. So we'll see some changes, much of it coming from the private sector.
Monica in Schaumburg, Illinois, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Would that be me?
That would be you.
I called from Schaumburg. Okay. Hi, Wendell. I am really, really excited about this. My husband and I have been unable to get insurance for a long period of time. Well, I went on the Kaiser Family Foundation website, which was linked from the White House website. And, you know, I went to the healthcare.gov thing, and then there was a link to go to that premium subsidy calculator. And what I found out is if you make anything over $60,140, then you're not subsidized. I understand that's 400% of the poverty line. And our premium would be $9,800 a year plus the $12,700 out-of-pocket expense for the silver plan. And, you know, I fail to see how that's affordable. I mean, that's a third of our income because we will definitely use that copay. And what I was wondering if there's, I put in a couple extra zeros there to see how that impacts people at a much higher income, and they're going to pay the same premium we are. In other words, once you're unsubsidized and, you know, you type in your age, once you're unsubsidized, everybody pays the same premium. I just think they should have had a more graduated slope.
A more progressive system.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. I think there are certainly shortcomings of the law. I don't like the fact, quite frankly, that it is built on the current system of health insurance, and it is built on insurance policies of the what is in vogue right now of a lot of people having to pay a lot out of their own pockets. But it was all that was able to get passed through Congress. It does a lot of good for a lot of people, and some people in your age category, and I would probably suggest that I am one of your peers, at least will be able to get access to coverage, and insurance companies will not be able to charge people more than three times as much as a younger person. In many states now, it's 10 times as much, if there's a limit at all. So it's not perfect by any means, but it puts some restraints on what insurance companies can get away with.
Patsy in Kyles Ford, Tennessee. You're on the air with I'm so used to saying Senator Sanders, with Wendell Potter.
Wendell, this is Pat Dickens. I have talked to someone earlier before. First of all, can the state stop the Affordable Care Act from coming in?
No. No, okay. Pat, cannot. The state cannot. Now, Tennessee is one of the states that is not expanding the Medicaid program next year, which is regrettable. I'm from Tennessee. I wish that lawmakers had seen the wisdom of expanding the Medicaid program like half of the states are doing. But it cannot stop most of the other provisions of the Affordable Care Act. It cannot block the marketplace that will be up and running tomorrow, and all the other provisions that will affect Americans in other states will apply to Tennesseans as well.
Okay, and another thing I wanted to ask is I'm a senior citizen, so I have the Medicare, and I have to get a supplemental insurance, and I know all the companies, you know, have different fees. So would the Affordable Care Act do anything to help that as far as getting a supplemental insurance?
Well, even the Medicare program is far from perfect because Medicare beneficiaries in the traditional program do have to pay quite a bit out of their own pocket if they had to go to the hospital, which is why a lot of people do buy private Medicare supplement policies to cover that gap or that out-of-pocket obligation. They'll still be available. The Affordable Care Act doesn't help you pay for the supplement, but it does help you in paying for your prescription medications. As you undoubtedly know, one of the features of the Prescription Drug Act for the Medicare program created something called the donut hole. After it pays a certain amount for your drugs, it stops paying until you've paid a lot out of your own pocket, and that's called the donut hole. and it's going to be, it already is closing that, so that you will be paying, probably already are paying less for your medications than you were last year or the year before.
Gary in Santa Ana, California. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Wendell.
Hey, Jerry.
I'm a disabled vet. I have a house we're making mortgage payments on. We have money in the bank. My wife was diagnosed with sciatica by the company doctor. Then she got laid off from the company and haven't been able to get work since. So what about us that sit in this unique position of having, you know, some money in the bank, but, I mean, we can't get employed. I'm disabled myself, as I said, a vet. But I
so your income is zero between the two of you, Gary?
Zero. We file nothing.
Wow. Well, you will be among the biggest beneficiaries of the law because with that low income, you will be able to get a pretty good deal on your coverage. And know this, regardless of your wife's or your medical condition, insurance companies cannot take that into consideration when they're pricing your policies. They can take your age into consideration, but not they can't charge you more than three times as much as anybody else. And because you have low income, you'll be able to qualify for tax credits and subsidies that will help you pay for your out-of-pocket expenses. So people like you are those who I think will benefit the most and deservedly so.
He lived, as I recall, he was calling from California, I think.
That's right.
California is expanding Medicaid. And so wouldn't that mean that as, you know, having an income of zero, that he'd be eligible basically for fully subsidized health insurance? For free health insurance?
I think so. You're right. And you can find that out when you go to, I think it's Covered California, or you can go to healthcare.gov starting tomorrow, and you can find out if you're going to be, you very well may be eligible to enroll in the expanded Medicaid program for both you and your wife. If not, you'll be able to qualify for the tax subsidies. Thanks for noting that, Tom.
Yeah. This is one of the great things, and it just boggles my mind that so many of these Republican governors said, no, we won't take free money to give to poor people in our state to buy health insurance. I mean, to provide health care to them. It just boggles my mind. We'll be right back. Wendell Potter's with us answering your questions about the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. Check out his website, WendellPotter.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can follow Wendell Potter at Wendell Potter. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Wendell Potter on the line with us. WendellPotter.com is website. You can follow his Twitter feed at Wendell Potter. And taking your call, Steve in Elgin, Illinois. Hey, Steve, you're on the air with Wendell.
Hi, Tom and Wendell. My question is this. I'm self-employed. I'm a musician, fairly low income. My wife lost her job. She's on unemployment. We have private insurance through Humana with very high deductibles. It's really more than we can afford, even at that. It's basically catastrophic coverage. Would we be able to simply drop our private insurance and sign up for insurance through the exchanges?
Yes, you can. You absolutely can do that. And I would encourage you to shop tomorrow between now and the end of March. But I think you probably can do better. You'll be able to compare one policy against another in ways that you've not been able to do before. You'll be able to understand what's covered and know what your out-of-pocket expenses will be. And you can even drill down to find out what doctors are and hospitals are included in a given health plan's network. So I think you should shop. I think you may find that you can get a better deal, and it sounds like you probably will be able also to get tax credits and subsidies.
Wendell, just a kind of a side question here. I used to own a travel agency back in the 80s, and travel agencies were necessary because you couldn't go online and buy your airplane tickets, and it was an enormous hassle booking on the telephone with the airline companies, and you couldn't compare things, and travel agents could do that instantly. Travel agencies have been largely put out of business by the Internet. Is the Affordable Care Act going to put health insurance agents, those salespeople out of business?
It's really going to change their lives considerably. The column I wrote today for the Huffington Post and the Center for Public Integrity is about that very thing. We're going to see both insurance companies And agents find that their jobs are going to be disintermediated, that they're middlemen that won't be as necessary as they have in the past.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Sam, you got a question for Wendell?
Yes, Professor Hartman. All right, I'm asking for my son, who's 30 years old. Okay, he's in good health. He's got a few minor problems where he had his neck broke, but it healed up. Okay, he works every day, 10 to 12 hours a day. He likes his work. You know, he's in good physical shape. It's clear $100. How much do you think, sir, that he should be charged monthly for his insurance?
Well, I don't think there's a real good way to answer that because it depends on what kind of coverage he wants. One of the things that you'll be able to find when you do shop for coverage beginning tomorrow is there are different levels of coverage, and you'll be able to buy a bronze, silver, gold, or platinum policy, and each one has costs a different amount of money. If you get a bronze policy, your premiums will be lower than if you get a silver or gold or platinum, but you'll have to pay more out of your own pocket if you get sick. So there are trade-offs. You'll just have to determine what works best for you individually or for your family.
Jeff in New Lisbon, Wisconsin. You have a question for Wendell?
Yes, Tom and Wendell Potter. If you would, for those of us who do not have computers, or those of us who are a little bit too old to use computers, if there's a phone number, of either a federal phone number on an 800 number that could be used by those of us who don't have computers.
Yes. How does somebody sign up if they don't have Internet access? Good question, Jeff.
There absolutely, thank you. Yeah, there absolutely is. You can also call an insurance agent. They're not yet disintermediated, so you can work through an agent or a broker. And I don't have the number at my fingertips, but I can get that so that you can.
So there is a federal toll-free number. Plus, you can just look in the local Yellow Pages and call an insurance agent, and they can sign you up.
Right, or an insurance company directly. But there will be a toll-free number for help for the federal government and the exchanges, healthcare.gov, and we can get that phone number for you.
Okay, Kevin in Chicago. Hey, Kevin, you're on the air with Wendell.
Afternoon. A concern with I understand the IRS is will fine people or penalize people for not having insurance, and this is something where they want to get all the people in the United States insured. How does the illegal immigrants fall into that? Because they don't even know where they're at. So if they go to the hospital or they go somewhere, are they going to get medical treatment? I know there's a couple questions there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Affordable Care Act, the way it was written, those who are undocumented residents of the United States here illegally or legally, quite frankly, are not eligible to participate in the exchanges. So they are excluded from the Affordable Care Act. That doesn't mean that they will be turned away from hospitals. Hospitals have long had a requirement that they have to treat people who are sick who show up in the emergency room. So that will still be the case. They can't turn people away regardless of their citizenship. But okay. The Affordable Care Act does not apply to people who are not citizens.
Wendell, I just got a 50-second cue here from Danielle. Mark in New York is asking, can they charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition? I think the answer to that is no.
The answer is no. And
okay.
By the way, that 800 number is 800-318-2596.
Right. And Jim just handed that to me, and I'll give that out tomorrow as well. And then also Donald in Aurora, Illinois, wants to know, how similar is Mass health care to ACA?
Very, very similar. The ACA was built largely or modeled after the Massachusetts health plan.
After
There's
Romney
some, obviously some differences.
Yeah.
But they're very different, very, very much the same.
Okay. And then Janet has a question. Can you apply to the for ACA prior to retirement?
Yeah. This is one of the biggest benefits. I'm not sure exactly what she means, but it's available to anyone if you are going to be unemployed one way or another,
right,
and you're not eligible for Medicare. You sure can.
Okay. Wendell Potter, WendellPotter.com. Thank you, Wendell.
Thank you, Tom.
It is always great talking to you. I so appreciate you being with us today. Wendell Potter. Check out his website at WendellPotter.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Wendell Potter. And, you know, we'll be back tomorrow. It's going to be a really interesting day. The ACA kicks in, and the federal government might kick out. And don't forget, democracy requires your participation. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.